Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. Let's turn our attention back to the book of Isaiah, where that prophet is recording some of the events that happened around the time that the Assyrians invaded Judea and tried to take over the city of Jerusalem, but they didn't get it done. And so this is the story of how that happened. We have parallels in 2 Chronicles 32, as well as in 2 Kings 19. But we want to look at the prophet's writing. Isaiah 37, verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. This is the threatening letter from King Sennacherib of Assyria. It repeats all the things that the big guy, Rabshakeh, had spoken just outside the walls to all the Israelis in their own language, in Jewish language, the Hebrew language, that they shouldn't be trusting Hezekiah, they shouldn't be trusting he who is, that the Assyrians are irresistible. But Sennacherib is now kind of under the gun. He's being pressured by intelligence that the king of Cush, Ethiopia, the king of the Egyptian corridor, is moving his direction to basically engage him. And so Sennacherib can't really wait much longer before he can dig in to fortified cities such as Jerusalem to prepare for this Cushite, this Ethiopian move on his positions. And so Hezekiah takes the letter, the threatening letter, and he reads it for himself, realizes there's nothing he can do about it. But there is one that can. So Hezekiah went up to the house of he who is and spread it out before he who is. Now, once again, I suggest that the king had a special dispensation to approach closer to the temple building than any other non-Levitical Israeli. And I base that on the fact that the kings took their oath of office between the two pillars on the front of the temple entrance, the pillars underneath the tower at the front of the temple. And so I believe that the king could go back to that same spot from time to time for important purposes. Well, this is a very important purpose. He wants to come and show God the hate mail that God got. So I picture him, Hezekiah, getting down on his hands and knees there between the two pillars, Yakin and Boaz, meaning he shall establish in strength. And right there, where priests go in and out all day long to minister before God in the holy place and to minister to the people in the worship courtyard. I think right there on that threshold, he rolls this scroll out flat. And then, verse 15, Hezekiah prayed to he who is. Oh, he who is of the armies, of the hosts, God of Israel, enthroned above the Gerubim. Now remember, 60 cubits away from him, just a little over 60 cubits from him, is the Holy of Holies. He might actually be able to see all the way to the Golden Prayer Altar, and then behind that will be the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant is. He might actually be able to see the Ark of the Covenant, at least in part. And the Ark of the Covenant is the throne of God, and God is pictured as sitting on the mercy seat with the two cherubim on either end of that mercy seat, having their wings go up and over the top like a canopy. And so God is enthroned above the cherubim, right there. Now, in the spiritual world, God is enthroned above the cherubim as well. Remember the tower that we see in the book of Ezekiel of God's glory? It has four cherubim down below the throne, holding up the platform on which the throne is situated. So Hezekiah believes in all of that, and he incorporates it into his language. He addresses the God who is enthroned both in heaven and on earth, both literally and figuratively, upon the cherubim. You are the God. You alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made the heavens and the earth. Now that's a direct response to the nasty things that are in this letter, that none of the other gods of the region could protect their people from the coming of the Assyrians. Why would Yahweh be any different? Yahweh can't stand up against Ashur. He can't stand up against Sennacherib. Well, the truth of the matter is, as Hezekiah lays it out here, there is really only one true God, the Creator Himself. Verse 17, incline your ear, O he who is, and hear. Open your eyes, O he who is, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. When Solomon built and dedicated this temple, his dedication prayer included a lot of talk about when Israelis get into dire straits, when they get into rough times, bad times that come because of sin, and they repent, and they come to this place, this temple building, and pray and seek your face, then hear from heaven and heal your land. And so Hezekiah is invoking that concept here. He says, God, look at this letter. Listen to what is being said. He's mocking you. Verse 18, truly, O he who is, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. And therefore, they were destroyed. And so Hezekiah again identifies a big difference between all these other gods and goddesses that the Assyrian king Sennacherib said, we took over. They are not the creator God. They are not the true and living God. They are God wannabes at the most. And they all are represented by idols that are human made, which the Assyrians took away and destroyed. God is not chained to some sort of physical image. The Ark of the Covenant, yes, is his throne on earth, but he is not chained to it. And just by destroying it, they can't destroy his reign. And by the way, they won't get a chance to destroy it. By my studies, I think the Ark of the Covenant disappeared before any non-Israeli enemy could ever get their hands on it. The next time the Ark of the Covenant is mentioned after the time of basically Josiah is in the book of Revelation, where it is in the heavenly sanctuary. And you've heard me probably say before, I am of the conviction that God confiscated it before the Jewish temple of Solomon was destroyed in 587 BC. And he has secured it away in the heavenly realms, from which it will return with Jesus and serve as his literal throne. That's my personal opinion. And so here is Hezekiah saying, yes, all these other gods and goddesses that the Assyrians are bragging about them doing in, they were just idols. They were just wannabes. You're the real deal. Verse 20, so now, O he who is our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are he who is. So the prayer is that God will demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt who has the power here. Verse 21, then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus says he who is the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me concerning Sennacherib of Assyria, this is the word that he who is has spoken concerning him. Okay, so Hezekiah is up at the temple offering this prayer, laying that nasty gram out on, I think, the temple threshold. And Isaiah is somewhere else in Jerusalem, and God speaks to Isaiah and gives him a message in response to the prayer of Hezekiah. Here is that message, verse 22. This is the word that he who is has spoken concerning him, meaning Sennacherib. She despises you. She scorns you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. So the picture here is that Jerusalem, the holy city, the Temple Mount at the core of that holy city, Zion itself, the center of God's reign with the Israeli people, personified as a young woman, is just shaking her head, like, what are you doing? Who do you think you are? Verse 23, whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? So again, the city of Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem effectively are like, what are you doing? Who are you mocking? Do you realize who you've insulted here? Verse 23 finishes, against the Holy One of Israel. You are making fun of the real God. By your servants you have mocked the Lord. You've said, with my many chariots, I've gone up the heights of the mountains to the far recesses of Lebanon to cut down its tallest cedars, its choicest cypresses, to come to its remotest height, its most fruitful forest. So now we picture Sennacherib thinking that he is so powerful. He's gone up to Lebanon. And some of the places he mentioned defeating are up in that very area. So he rode his war chariots up there, and he started chopping down the forest of Lebanon. Now, not literally. Sometimes we've seen prophetically that kings and people groups are pictured as trees, and they get hacked down by warfare. And so, yeah, Sennacherib's been chopping down a whole bunch of trees. Verse 25, I dug wells and drank waters to dry up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. Now, that's a big brag. He hasn't done that, and he's not going to get a chance to do that. That's probably next on his agenda. So basically he says, I go anywhere I want, I dig wells where I want, I drink the water I want, and I'm going to go and dry up the Nile, or I'm going to dry up the heads or the tributaries, the seven streams of the Nile in the Delta. It'll be mine. Verse 26. Have you not heard that I determined it long ago? I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you should make fortified cities crash into heaps of ruins, while their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded, and have become like plants of the field, like tender grass, like grass on the housetops, blighted before it's grown. So God's response is, are you not paying attention? I already sent this information out through my prophets years ago that you were going to be able to come and do all this stuff you've been doing. But it's not going to be the way you want it. I'm the one that's in control. You are just my instrument. You are you're my rod. You're my razor. Those were the images that we saw in the prophetic literature earlier. Verse 28, God continues in his message to Sennacherib's nasty letter. I know you're sitting down and you're going out and coming in and you're raging against me. So I know all about your attitude. Because you have raged against me and your complacency has come to my ears, I'm going to put a hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth, and I will turn you back on the way by which you came. Now, one of the ways you controlled animals was you controlled their head. For horses, a bit in the mouth. Worked perfectly fine. Worked for a lot of the animals. For some of the more aggressive animals, putting a little hook or a ring in their nose, the very sensitive septum area. You know, you put it on there and put a string or a rope on that thing, and you can jerk them one way or the other and make them move. And so God says, look here, Sennacherib, I know you inside and out. And I'm going to treat you like an animal. I'm going to treat you like a disobedient domestic beast. And I'm going to whip your head right around and send you back to Assyria. Now, verse 30. This shall be the sign for you. This is for the Judeans, for Hezekiah and others. This year you shall eat what grows of itself, and in the second year what springs from that. Then in the third year sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. Now what happens here is that when you have an army that's invaded your land, you don't get to harvest the crop very easily. You can't have a massive harvest time. So that also impedes your planting time. So the Israelis have had their agricultural cycle disrupted by the Assyrians. But the promise here is that by the third year hereafter, they will get to sow and reap and do all their agricultural work. It'll all be back to, quote, normal, end quote. Verse 31, and the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. So God uses agriculture as a symbol regarding how Judea is going to be okay. Even though they have suffered with this Assyrian invasion, God's intervention is going to make them fruitful again. And this will also be sealed as a promise with the cycle here of production. How by the third year coming around, everything will be back to normal. Verse 32, "For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of he who is of the hosts will do this." Now, this is one of those places where we are reminded again that at some point in the future, not now, not this time around, the Judeans will suffer the loss of Jerusalem. They will suffer the loss of the temple. They will suffer the loss of their land, and they will go into exile. But God will work with that little remnant group that goes into exile to bring them back again, to continue his work. We've seen that in several of our prophetic books. And so here's a little bit of that just kind of popped in here in the letter or in the message that Isaiah passes on to Hezekiah. Verse 33, "Therefore, thus says he who is concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, or shoot an arrow there, or come before it with a shield, or cast up a siege mound against it." See, none of that has happened yet. He's carried on military operations at Lachish and Libna. But he's only sent his Rabshakeh, his big guy, up to threaten the Judeans, trying to get them to submit and surrender. So there's not been any military action against the capital city. And God says, it's not going to happen. Verse 34, "By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declares he who is. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." So that's the promise that God makes to King Hezekiah and the people of Judah and Jerusalem, that the Assyrians are going to be sent packing, and Jerusalem will not even have the beginning of a siege ramp. They won't even have any arrows shot at them. The Assyrians are going to be gone. And that is exactly what happens. Verse 36, "The angel of he who is went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians." One angel taking out 185,000 armed soldiers in a single night. Now, that's not the entirety of the Assyrian army. That's just a significant portion of it. But it is enough to scare them into leaving. I mean, if you wake up and there's 185,000 of your fellow soldiers dead and there's no explanation for it, that's a good reason to leave. Especially if you're a little bit on the superstitious side and you believe that the spirit world sometimes takes vengeance against you. Now, it is interesting that the Assyrian records, I believe, include something about how this expedition suddenly had an infestation of mice, which chewed up all their bowstrings and chewed up the leather on their military equipment. And once they lost that equipment, they had to abandon this invasion. Herodotus, I think, is the one, a Greek historian, that mentions this idea that they had to leave because they had been attacked by these rodents. Some have suggested that maybe the mice brought disease with them. Maybe. But it says here in our text that an angel was involved in it. And so we're going to go with that. So when the people rose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. And so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed. He returned home and lived at Nineveh. So he took the hint, a very big hint, leave or die. And so he decides to leave. Now, when he gets back, there's a number of years that he continues reigning before finally his own people get their fill of him. Verse 38 says, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, Adrammelech and Sharezer, his son, struck him down with the sword. And after that, they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. So he ends up with family problems, and there is an assassination. Now, that's a little bit farther into the future, but it is mentioned in connection with the fact that he had to retreat from Jerusalem. Even though he had earlier reported in his own records that he had trapped Hezekiah in the city of Jerusalem, just like a caged bird. But he didn't get a chance to take the bird because the bird's god let him out of the cage and threatened the one that stuck him there. And so this is how Hezekiah ends up coming to the awareness of other groups that want to resist the Assyrians. Groups like the Babylonians who want to be free. And they will be involved in our next story.